Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
I wanted to highlight this very hyper-local story. My cousin shared this with me. Our intern shared it with me, and a lot of you actually reached out about it. And when I checked on this page on Facebook, it had close to 5,000 followers all efforting to help this local family. So a Shelton resident giving away $5,000 to find his five-year-old dog, Louie. Jason Petrini has started a campaign, Let's Bring Louie Home, after his dog went missing last month. And this morning, we wanted to talk about this story, get it out there to all of you. And so we're not only talking to Jason Petrini, who, good morning, so glad that you could be here, Jason. We also have Carol Ferrucci here, who is with the Connecticut Dog Gone Recovery Group. And so we're going to talk about both aspects of this. So welcome both of you to the show. So glad you could be here.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
So, Jason, let's start with you. Can you start by just telling us a little bit about what happened with Louie? Tell us about, you know, who he is, but also what led up to him disappearing.
Sure, yeah. Louie was, his birthday's actually coming up Labor Day weekend. He's going to be 6 years old. But I was on vacation in Europe. It was about a two-year trip that was planned, and obviously because of COVID, things kind of dampened that, but this summer was the summer. And so I got a call about 3 weeks into it, another week to go, that the pet sitter lost the dog. He ran out of the gate and took off. And it's been boots on the ground and really trying to build this huge campaign just to get the word out to find him. He's a rescue dog, very friendly. Obviously, right now he's skittish. We are getting reports, but it seems like it's the same pattern where he comes out of the woods, goes between neighborhoods, and then, you know, we get no sightings for multiple days on end, probably because of the heat. So it's just very important that we do get the word out. And there is a $5,000 reward just in case somebody did take them. I don't think that's the case, but at this point, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to get them home.
Tell us about your story of getting Louie. You said he's a rescue?
Yeah, so Louie's actually a twin. And everyone, my friends were like, well, Jay, aren't all dogs twins? The truth is, he was the only two dogs in the litter that made it. And his brother Jackson, he's a big teddy bear, but you know, I was looking to adopt one, and I saw both of them. They're in you know, just all love. So I'm a twin. I felt connected to it, and I felt that, you know, that was a sign. So growing Louie and the four other siblings, five pit bulls in total, all rescues, it was quite the happy house, if you know what I mean. And through the years, I think one of my biggest gifts is watching Louie, you know, raise him as a puppy into an adult. And working from home has been the biggest gift because I was able to spend countless hours with him every day, you know, watching him just do what dogs do and just with full love.
Mm. It is really special. I know we for the most part, have always had rescues, and there's nothing like them. There really isn't. And there is one thing, though, with rescues. Unfortunately, sometimes in their nature, they can be skittish. They can be very nervous of other people because a lot of times it's their background. Now, I don't know what Louie went through, but I know, like, for our rescue pup, he was left in a box on a highway for 8 days before he was found. So he doesn't trust people.
Wow.
He doesn't like people. He gets very nervous when people come to the house. He's very on edge. He's a great family dog, not a great people person dog. So I don't know. What is Louie's demeanor sort of like? You know, like, what's been the experience for people who have spotted him?
Yeah, so he's been skittish. He's, you know, they see him always kind of doing this swaggerish walk in between yards, and he's never just kind of standing still. And there's two sides to that. I know when a dog goes in survival mode, it's, you know, shelter, food, water, and you know, find the safe haven. And I guess there's a chemical that's released, and Carol can talk more about this, but when they do go in survival mode, it's basically, it's that. You know, but normal Louie, in normal circumstance, he's a cuddle bug. He loves people. He's actually really smart. I can't tell you how many times I would see him open up doors with his mouth, literally put the big doorknob in the corner of his mouth and turn his face and open the door. He's just a really smart dog. Yeah,
wow.
I know. And so, you know, at this point, we're hitting, I think, 6 weeks Thursday. And it just, you know, the community here, and in Shelton, Trumbull, and all the surrounding towns have been the nucleus behind this search and rescue, but most importantly, I've never seen this type of support, not over a dog named Louie, and definitely not over a pit bull. So for those that are listening, we call them Team Louie. They are absolutely amazing, and we call them our protectors, because if it wasn't for them and everyone helping, I don't think we would have been this far into the search and rescue. And when I say I'm getting anywhere from 10 to 15 calls a day, not just Louie reports, but other dogs, that's exactly what that is. And, you know, hundreds of messages and emails. It's been quite the fan base, and I want to kind of take this as far as I can get it, as long as I keep it relevant. And that's my biggest concern, is it, you know, becomes old news. You know, so Melissa, the fact that you had us on the radio today just to get our story out there means nothing. It's just amazing. It means the world to me.
Oh, well, I mean, listen, from one dog parent to another, even if I didn't have a dog myself, you know, animals, the one thing I always say to people, and I know sometimes I get slack for it, but since I was a kid, I used to get in so much trouble, because I'm sure this isn't socially acceptable to say, but if I was driving a car, I mean, all of when I was like in fifth grade, because I wasn't driving, but I always would tell people, if I'm driving a car and there's a dog in the middle of the road or there's a person, I'm probably going to hit the person, only because you should know better and you can speak on your behalf and the dog can't.
Right.
You know, like that's just how I've always been. And I think you are very lucky, Jason, because you do live in a state where a lot of people love the dogs. And I know I'm seeing it online. You are getting an incredible amount of, you know, word of mouth, flyers being posted, businesses, mailboxes. I mean, there's just it's really amazing. There's a GoFundMe I know that's set up in a Facebook page. And through your story, I wish I had known about it earlier, but I'm so glad I got connected. Through your story, I learned about Connecticut Dog Gone Recovery, which is where you come in, Carol.
Yeah.
Good morning. Thousands of you have seen it online. Many of you have reached out to me. Even my own cousin was like, have you heard about this? Let's bring Louie home. So a Shelton resident, and we've introduced you to him, Jason Petrini, who is here. And we're talking about his dog, Louie. Wait, Chris, don't go anywhere. I need you to connect them. Thank you. Jason has introduced us to his dog, Louie. And I wanted to talk now to Carol Ferrucci, because she's with Connecticut Dog Gone Recovery. And I have to be honest with you, Carol. I know a lot, but I don't know everything. I had never heard of Connecticut Dog Gone Recovery. What is that organization and how long has it been around?
We started probably like in, I think it was 2014. We are a 501c.
No, I got you. The 501c3 nonprofit.
Yes,
that's awesome.
We service all of Connecticut. We do consults for people sometimes that are out of state, but mainly we focus on this area here, and we basically provide volunteer services for anyone who has lost their dog. So people can call us. We have a website that people can reach out to us on. It's ctdgrv.org. That's Connecticut Dog Gone Recovery Volunteers.org. And in there, people can fill out a volunteer form. I mean, they can fill out a lost dog form. And we have people then, you know, it goes into our referrals, and one of our volunteers that lives closest to the area will pick it up and reach out to the person that lost their dog to help work with them.
So I think that's really amazing. And you guys have been around, it'll be almost 10 years in a couple of years, which is great. How many dogs on average would you say? And of course, there are so many that are not reported, but how many dogs on average would you say are reported missing? Like on a yearly basis?
On a yearly basis. Last year, I think we did over, I do have specific counts, but not right in front of me, but it was
That's
over
okay.
900 dogs we did.
Wow.
Alone. And not all dogs are reported to us, so that's just the ones that we received.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we average right now, our counts are about between 60 and 80 lost dogs a month. And we have our high peaks, like when you get in the summertime or July 4th in particular, our numbers go way up. We're very, very busy, like a month before July 4th to a month after July 4th. That's when the fireworks are out, the thunderstorms from summer. It keeps us hopping.
So what are some of the services like that you offer for people who you know, they find out, you know, my dog is gone. It's been a couple of days, no sign of the dog. Like, what are things that Connecticut Dog Gone Recovery does?
The first thing we're going to do is do a consult with the lost dog owner to find out what happened and find out some information about the dog and some history about the dog. And from there, we'll develop a plan with the people. In general, I would say in a large majority of the cases, like we did with Jason, is we start with posters to get the word out. We use social media, but social media, not everyone is on social media, and we tell our lost dog owners that all the time. So what we do is we then get posters out, and we have a very specific way of making them after years of doing this where we know people will see them and where to place them. We're very specific on what kind of material to use. And we'll get these up generally in a 3 to 5 mile radius in a case like in Jason's where we may need to expand out even further, and we do. We'll do that also. And we look to get some sightings. In a case like what we're doing with Jason, and I think it is a good idea, is we ask people if you see the dog to take a picture. And then, you know, let the owner know. And we ask people not to post sightings on Facebook, but to call the owner. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is because we want the owner to be aware as quickly as possible. And two, we want to make sure the area is kept quiet in case the dog is in what's known as survival mode, which you briefly touched on. And because we don't want people accidentally
spooking
the dog out
I would think the best bet would be if the owner could get there. That's your best bet of getting the dog, is if the owner could get there.
Yeah
that makes sense. Totally.
Because, you know, a stranger is a lot of dogs are not going to come to a stranger.
Yeah, exactly.
Or even with the owner, sometimes when they go into survival mode, the dog will not recognize their owner right away.
I've heard of that
and
happening.
And that's who we start working with the owners. And we actually even send some videos of showing how to work with a dog that is in survival mode to get them to come to you. And it's basically having the owner get low to the ground and not to approach towards the dog, but to sit quietly and to try to lure the dog to them, having the dog maybe getting used to their scent or noticing them, and patiently waiting for the dog on its terms to come to you rather than you trying to force that on the dog. Because if you do, it triggers that flight mode and the dog will run.
And we're
very successful with this method a lot of times. We do get a lot of dogs that when we coach the owners, they use this method, and the dog will eventually come to them. But the best thing is to use the owner.
Well, I think this is an amazing opportunity for people to learn again about Connecticut Dog Gone Recovery. If you want to learn more, go to the website ctdgrv.org. And in the meantime, Louie, if you are out there, my friend, if you're listening for some reason to a radio, that's very impressive. But anyone who sees Louie, please make sure that you send that information over. There is a Facebook page. Again, Let's Bring Louie Home. And Jason, I wish you nothing but luck. I am a prayer warrior. I will be praying that Louie comes home very soon, and I thank you both for coming on this morning.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, Let's Bring Louie Home, and we will have this up on our podcast so you can learn more. And if you want more information, we have that for you as well at WICC600.com. I want to welcome to the morning show for the first time Leora Levy. She is the Republican candidate running for U.S. Senate and representing Connecticut and going up against incumbent Senator Richard Blumenthal. Good morning, Leora Levy. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. So first and foremost, welcome to the morning show. I know you've been on the Lisa Wexler show before, but I'm glad to have you here. And for our listeners, we'd love to get to know you a little bit better. Tell us about yourself.
Well, I'm first of all, a wife and a mother. I've raised 3 great sons here in Connecticut. I was an international businesswoman, one of the first women international commodity traders in the world at the time that I was doing that in the late 70s through the mid 80s. I was also you know, very involved in my community. I was chairman of the board of the Bruce Museum here in Greenwich. I led a public-private partnership to relocate and build a new animal shelter. I was involved with, well, I led an effort to furnish the first mild traumatic brain injury clinic at Bagram Air Force Base in the early 2000s when the Afghanistan war was a hot war because the government was going to take 6 months to do it. And I organized 50 friends and a few local businesses. We did it in 6 weeks and sent enough for them to open a second clinic as well in Afghanistan. Those are the types of things that I do. I'm a very involved person. And first of all, I escaped Cuba. My family came here with nothing. We escaped communism. And I love this country. I could not stand by and allow what is happening to our country to continue. And that is why I am running for Senate. I'm running to make the lives of the families and especially our children and our children's children better here in Connecticut, to make sure they have the same opportunity to live an American dream that I have had.
So, Leora, we are partners with News 8, and we did watch the coverage before the primaries, and I know one of the sound bites that continued to be aired on some of their promotions was a quote from you: "I am not a career politician." But for people who hear that and they say, "Oh, okay, so here's somebody who's never been in it," I do want to let people know, if you go to Leora's, she's got a website if you want to learn more, leoraforcct.com, and under the About section, it does say right there that you served as the Republican National Committee woman for the state of Connecticut since 2016. So tell us sort of what really, I understand why you wanted to get into the political realm, but while it's not maybe your main title, it does look like you do have obviously experience in politics. So I wanted to just highlight that a little bit for people who are wondering.
Sure. I have experience as a volunteer. Everything I've ever done has been as a volunteer. I have never been a candidate before. I have advised candidates on policy. I've helped them finance their campaigns, but I've never been a candidate myself. I have never served in elective office, but it is time. These jobs are not jobs for life. Our founders did not expect that we were going to have a political class that just spends their life in a bubble in Washington. I am from Connecticut. I live in Connecticut. I'm just a regular, normal, everyday person, but I'm very concerned about what's happening to our country. And I have the background and I have life experience. For instance, I was nominated to be an ambassador. I was nominated to be ambassador to Chile. But, my nomination was blocked, along with a whole group of other State Department nominees, not for anything that we've done, did or didn't do, but simply for pure politics. So I've lived a lot, and I see what happens in Washington. I'm going to Washington to serve the people of Connecticut, to make sure that their lives are better, to make sure that they can keep more of their own money that they earn, to stop the spending that's created inflation, to reinvigorate our American energy production, to reduce the lawlessness and the crime. I will always have the backs of our police. I will support our police and work to make sure that our laws are enforced against criminals, and this revolving door justice system, to work on a better legal immigration system, because what's happening today is not immigration, it's an invasion. And I say that as a legal immigrant who believes in immigration. And I will also always stand with parents. I am a parent. As I said, I raised three sons here in Connecticut. If someone had told me I was a domestic terrorist, or that I couldn't be involved with their education, or did not have the final say of their medical care, they would have more than a tiger mom to deal with.
We're talking to Leora Levy this morning, who is the Republican candidate running for Senate up against Senator Blumenthal. As you talk about things coming into the country, fentanyl, today is Drug Overdose Awareness Day in Connecticut. It was signed into proclamation, I guess, this morning. And as we talk about it,
Here's a question from a listener. Leora, what would you do to stop the drugs from coming across the border into Connecticut?
The first thing we should do is close the border. That, if we close the border, they will have a much harder time bringing it into our country. We absolutely need to expand services for people who are suffering from drug addiction, Narcan. We need to expand the availability of Narcan, but we wouldn't need it if we closed the border. And that includes allow the Border Patrol to do their jobs and enforce the law. It includes building a wall or a barrier of some sort where it makes sense. It includes electronic surveillance, drones, whatever it takes. But we must get control of that border because the majority of the fentanyl in this country is coming across the border. It comes from China to Mexico, and the Mexican cartels are bringing it into our country. They are killing our young Americans. It's the number one killer of young Americans between 18 and 45. Over 100,000 young Americans died last year from drug overdoses due to fentanyl. We must get control of that border. And frankly, it's coming here because Biden and Blumenthal and Mayorkas think it's a good idea to let unknown, just hordes of people come into our country without knowing who they are or why they're coming or what their intentions are.
We're chatting with Leora Levy this morning. Leora, can you hold on for one moment?
So the parents feel as though it's their responsibility to shape the schools, which then shape the kids. So because I can't get past the parents, do I really have as much of an influence on the kids as I want? I try in my own way, but right now my job is to hire the right teachers.
So the audio is pretty horrible, to put it bluntly. It's very hard to hear, but that is just a snippet of a very long video that dropped yesterday, released by Project Veritas, and it shows Koskob Elementary School Assistant Principal Jeremy Boland admitting he does not hire certain teachers because his goal is to have as many teachers on staff sneak liberal ways of thinking into their children, or I should say into their teaching methods for children. And so we have Leora Levy here this morning, which I think it's interesting, the timing of this. I did not plan it this way. It just kind of happened. But Leora Levy, you mentioned you're from Greenwich. This is right in your neck of the woods. I'd imagine you heard this story and would love to get your comment on it and then really talk about what you would want to do, or really what you'd like to see happen to make sure that hiring processes are not discriminatory, if in fact this is what's going on, not just in Greenwich, but in other school districts across Connecticut.
Thank you for that question. Frankly, my phone blew up last night.
Oh, really?
I think within 15 or 20 minutes, probably a dozen people sent this video to me by text. And it is disturbing on so many levels. It's wrong on so many levels. First of all, look, I told you I came from Cuba, where Castro there was a communist revolution. He took over January 1st of 1959. First thing he did, one, confiscate all the weapons, and two, indoctrinate the children. He indoctrinated them first to spy and inform on their parents. He replaced them as the father figure in their lives and then just infused them with his communist propaganda. And that's what's happening to our children. This is so disturbing to have this man admit that they are indoctrinating our children. And it is not liberal philosophy. Liberal philosophy is very different. This is progressive. This is progressive.
What's the difference? What's the difference?
The difference is liberal. Classical liberalism allows people to think critically. Progressives do not. Progressives have an objective to change this country into a socialist utopia, and that is what they're trying to do. He admitted it, that they are not teaching critical thinking. They are teaching a way of thinking that makes them malleable and makes them believe in their way of doing things, their thinking, for the rest of their lives. The discrimination in hiring is also disturbing. It was right there. Can you imagine? You know, they accuse conservatives of discriminating. That is a fallacy. He's laying it out there for everyone to hear.
So we had a caller who said that this individual should be fired. But even if it, first of all, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do.
So even if this person was fired, do you think, though, Leora Levy, that this is a trickle-down effect? Like, do you think this is a problem that we're seeing in many other districts, not just in Greenwich? Because other callers have said that, too.
You know, you'd have to ask people in other districts whose children are in those schools. I can't comment because I live here in Greenwich, and I had heard things from, you know, my children are adults now, but I had heard from parents whose kids are in the school now that they are teaching inappropriate curriculum, that they are trying to affect the way kids think about life and about themselves. So this is happening here. We obviously this proves it. This is one bit of evidence. I'm concerned also, even if you fire him, the teachers he hired are still there. How do you change things like without cleaning house completely? And I'm not advocating that, but perhaps there needs to be leadership from the Board of Ed, from the superintendent, and setting out a policy of what education actually means.
Leora Levy,
the goal is.
Yeah.
To teach it's to think critically, think for themselves, to teach actual history, not revisionist history, to teach to let parents handle sensitive issues rather than expose children to inappropriate sexual content and sexual curriculum. That's for the family, not the schools. You know, there's a lot going on that really is inappropriate, and it requires leadership in the school system.
Well, Leora Levy, I appreciate you coming on. I know we only got to really dive into both fentanyl and schools, but I do appreciate you even giving us a snippet of who you are, what you stand for. And again, if people want to learn more about your campaign, you can head on over to leora4ct.com. And Leora, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. One more important ingredient, our parents. Let the parents be more involved with the kids' education. Bring them in. Don't keep them out.
Well, Leora, I really appreciate you coming on and your comments this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. I enjoyed it. I hope you'll invite me back.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you.
It's time to get out and explore.
Melissa in the Morning brings you science you may not know on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Oh, man, we were so close to this very exciting first time journey in quite a long time up to the moon, but things had to get scrubbed on Monday. Artemis 1 now not launching for another couple of days at least. And this morning we're chatting with David Mestre, getting the very latest on the details. David, what the heck happened?
Yeah, well, you know, rocket science, it's hard.
It's not hard. As easy as they say, you know?
It's
good
not
Lord.
This. It's not. We're not.
Although, who's they? Who said it was easy?
Yeah. Well, you know,
they're crazy.
You see what? Yeah, I mean, the thing is that we've got these rocket engines on the SLS or the Space Launch System. And, you know, they got to be chilled because parts of these rocket engines, they have to operate at minus 430 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
And then once we kick those engines on, they're going to soar to temperatures, or parts of the rocket engine will soar to temperatures of 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And so if we don't do this right, you know, chill first and then ignite later, we could literally melt those engines. And so they hadn't chilled properly. So we were like, we're going to need to chill them a little more before we can actually turn these rocket engines on. And
what confused me about this is, like, first of all, I always find that I get so excited and then 9 times out of 10 weather gets in the way. So that looked like it was going to be the case, was weather was going to delay it. But then it was okay. So with something like this, that couldn't have been pre-tested before launch day?
It's funny you mentioned that. So what happened is that these four engines, they actually were tested before, and they worked. And so we're going back to that test to see, what did we do differently then that we did on Monday? And then we're just going to have to see if we can figure this out. Maybe we're going to need to chill them a little sooner and earlier, because this was the first time that the ground crew at the launch pad actually launched these rockets.
It wasn't interesting.
So now we're going to have to go back to the drawing board and said, okay, listen, we're going to need a different set of instructions to get these engines to light up and light up safely. And so we're going to have to go back to the rocket engineers that actually got it to actually work at the launch, at the launch stand, you know, like a little test stand. And then we're going to have to see if we can try and do the same thing. So they're going to try and do that. Plus there was a leak, too. So there was like all sorts of valves and leakings. So we had to like figure that out as well.
Well, what's interesting, David, in your notes that I thought, okay, maybe this has maybe something to do with it. Maybe I'm making this up. But I didn't realize this, that most of the rocket that's being used was actually made from used parts from NASA's space shuttle program. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's,
wow.
There's no new car smell here. No. No.
But is that why we had issues maybe? Because it's not brand spanking new?
Yeah, that's a good question. So part of it is that we know that this stuff actually works. So let's give you a couple of examples. So the Space Launch System has a what's called a core stage. It's a big orange tank with the cryogenic fuel, and on the bottom are four rocket engines. Well, those four rocket engines, they're a bit vintage.
Well, good grief. Okay. All right.
Yeah,
sounds
so
great.
They actually come from the space shuttle program. So the space shuttle orbiter actually, when it is launching, uses three what are known as RS-25 engines. They're actually stuck on the back of the space shuttle orbiter, and they give it a bit of a thrust to be able to go up into space. Not enough, but just enough to kind of get it started. And so what happens, these RS-25 engines, they actually are literally from the space shuttle program. Literally pulled them out of these old space shuttles. Three of the space shuttles are in our museums, but these rocket engines we kind of kept. And so there's one, engine 2045. That rocket engine alone has flown 12 times into space.
Oh, wow. So this is a veteran.
Yes, a veteran. Yeah, and in fact, it was actually first flown back in 1998.
Ooh,
yeah, so I can't even remember what the average cost of a home was in 1998, but I think it was probably considerably less. You know, I don't even know, we got to figure out, what was the songs. But 1998, that's when Google was founded. Okay, this is how far back this
Good
really
Lord.
Goes.
Good Lord, wow, that's really impressive. We're talking to David Mestre this morning. Unfortunately, the launch that we were very excited for earlier this week did not happen. It's now set for, I believe you said, this upcoming Saturday?
Yep, Saturday, okay. September 3rd, we're going to try and there's another launch window, and September 3rd, 2:17 p.m., we're going to give it another go.
Whew. I mean, do you feel like, David, I understand that these are, the parts that make up this rocket, they've done this before, this is no new news, but do you feel like if they have another, and again, not trying to be Debbie Downer here, but if they have another failed launch or they don't do it this upcoming weekend, do you think they'll go back to the drawing board and go, hey, you know what, maybe we need to upgrade some of these parts? Or do you think that's not really the issue here?
Yeah, no, I think part of it is that, we're putting together all of these rockets and all of these parts. And this is the first time that they've actually been configured in this way. We know that they worked during the space shuttle program. And we know they worked because, they have flight heritage. And eventually, though, we're going to go from these used parts to newer parts in the later Artemis missions. So Artemis 1, Artemis 2, Artemis 3, we're going to be going through some of these used but, flight-worthy and have flight heritage parts. And eventually we'll start to improve those parts and even make newer parts. But we could never have really gotten this system off the ground, because if we were to build a brand new rocket from scratch, it already would have been expensive. Even now, this is a very expensive system.
Oh, I'd imagine. Yeah.
We're looking at costs of just to launch Artemis missions of probably in the neighborhood of like $4 $1 billion to do a launch. You know,
wow.
So this is, but you know, this is what you know. I mean, and then this is you know, people say this is what you get when the designer of the rocket is Congress, because there are lots of contractors that have a hand in the building and the design and the making of these rockets. And so you know, parts come from literally all over the United States. Yeah. And so these are, you know, this is as much Congress's rocket in terms of, you know, hey, I'd like to get my state to be involved in space exploration. And so,
wow.
you know, there's companies in Milford or
right,
down in Stanford.
Right. It's just a big not free for all, but I know what you mean, where it's like you get random stuff from random places. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting.
And the other thing is that, you know, this is how we build an aerospace industry. Because, you know, we have companies that build, you know, some of these parts, and these parts have to be fabricated to very strict standards
Sure. In
order for us to be able to actually do this. I mean, like even just the rocket engine alone, you know, what piece of equipment can operate at temperatures of minus 430 degrees Fahrenheit up to 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit? I mean, there's that range of temperatures.
Yeah.
You know, a Ford can't do that.
Yeah, right. No, you're right. You're right, David. Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next few days. Certainly, we will keep a close eye on it, and you can always rely on David Mestre to give us the very latest scoop. David, thank you so much for checking in. Really appreciate it. Fingers crossed for this upcoming, hopefully,
Fingers
launch.
Fingers crossed for Saturday.
Oh, all right. David Mestre, Science You May Not Know, thank you so much.